and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on the programme.
For sure, lives are taken when air pollution goes up and they're saved when it goes down, but it's hard to draw the connection to the naked eye.
We continue our series on the elements, this week turning to the sky and unpacking all things about the air in our cities. We'll meet the author of a new book called Choked that takes a fresh approach to air pollution and how it affects our cities. And we'll also look at super typhoons in Hong Kong and how the island does battle with its gusty foe. Plus, the polar vortex crossing the United States and an ode to the creator of modern city living, the humble AC unit. That's all coming up right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. As we go to air, the US is shivering because of air, a polar vortex, a rush of cold air that pushes temperatures so low that you can get frostbite on any exposed skin. That's why in some cities, officials are advising people to stay indoors. I certainly would. Now, our America's editor-at-large is Ed Stocker, and he sent us this chilly post.
Stop, if you will, to ponder for a moment the weather conditions currently being experienced by America's Midwest. To call them frigid would be an understatement. The dreaded two words in the lexicon of the frantic Weather Channel reporter, polar vortex.
This weather event is called a polar vortex.
Polar vortex,
polar vortex.
A fragmenting polar vortex.
Freezing air descending south from the Arctic, dislodged by warmer air above it and spreading across swathes of the country. Add to the mix winds whipping in off the Great Lakes and you have a series of bitter wind chill factors in states such as Minnesota, Wisconsin and Illinois that started on Wednesday of this week. So what do cities do when this dreaded combination of air and wind descend on their metropolises? First and foremost, they need to be ready and resilient to weather the, well, weather.
Have a plan for your home, for your vehicle, before the extreme cold settles in, because once it's here, being outside will be dangerous.
Politics always has a part to play. Wary of the possible repercussions, leaders need to be speedy and assertive in their reaction, which means the government of the states of Michigan, Illinois, and Wisconsin all declared states of emergency this time around. Perhaps they recall ill-fated Chicago Mayor Michael Belandich, who, according to many, failed to get re-elected due to his botched reaction to the blizzard of 1979. In Chicago, where current Mayor Rahm Emanuel called a press conference to forewarn residents before the front arrived, the bright sunshine could do nothing to warm the Arctic air, with temperatures reading minus 29 degrees Celsius, going down to minus 37 degrees Celsius with the wind chill. Temperatures in the so-called Windy City reached their lowest since January of 1985.
The people of the city of Chicago, that their safety and their security is our number one priority in every neighborhood throughout the city of Chicago.
Beyond all the political posturing, there are also very real issues that cities need to deal with, from logistics to what to do with buildings that fall under their jurisdiction. In Chicago, the public school system announced that it was shutting for 2 days due to the deep freeze and safety concerns for students. And luckily for those students affected, 2 days will be added to the school year in order to make up the calendar. Cities also need to mobilise to help their homeless populations at a time when short outdoor exposure can lead to frostbite due to the brutal air temperatures. In Chicago, that meant a fleet of buses equipped with nurses travelling around the city and acting as mobile shelters. Well below freezing air and gusting winds throw up a host of infrastructure problems that can give urban areas plenty of headaches. How, for example, to keep transport running, The US media has been particularly gripped by how Chicago deals with the problem of the contracting metal and its train tracks shrinking from the cold and causing connection issues. The old school solution? Warming the tracks by initiating gas-fed fires that run alongside the tracks and keep them just right. It's quite the sight to see a train passing through these flames, and we're told not dangerous at all. Midwestern cities are, of course, used to all this despite the severity of the conditions this time around. But they've also arguably learnt from the mistakes they've made along the way. Having emergency procedures in place, educating residents about best practices, and keeping lines of communication open are key. City leaders will invariably take the heat if it all goes wrong. Staying one step ahead will mean that any controversy will quickly blow over. For Monocle in a chilly New York, I'm Ed Stocker.
We all know that city air is not always the healthiest, but are we aware of the terrifying impact air pollution really has on our bodies? And what can we do to minimise it? All these questions and some of the answers are featured in an upcoming book entitled Choked: The Age of Air Pollution and the Fight for a Cleaner Future. It's written by the environmental journalist Beth Gardner, and she joined me a little bit earlier to talk about the book and the stories that she discovered during 4 years of research.
Well, I've really tried to take a global look at this problem because it really is something that affects people all around the world. And I've taken readers to different places with each locale sort of intended to demonstrate and look at a different piece of the problem and some of the potential solutions that are out there. So, for example, there's a chapter about London, which is focused on diesel, but it's not really a London-specific problem. London is a window onto something that's much bigger, and this diesel issue has really been something that's affected cities across Europe. I've gone to Poland to look at coal. I've gone to China to look at some of the positive action that they're taking in terms of investment in wind and solar power to move away from dirty sources of energy. I've gone to Berlin to look at some of the sort of alternative ways that we can think of for getting around cities, which really, you know, bear on quality of life in areas, including air pollution, but not limited to air pollution.
Now, first of all, I was struck by my naivety in a way that, you know, I think that most of us, when we think about the pollution in our air, think there's one suspect, which is the motor car, and that's the big baddie. Now, of course, there is a lot of problems associated with diesel and with cars, which we should come to. But first of all, the numbers were striking, that some 4.2 million people, I think, a year have deaths associated with pollution that's probably from vehicle sources, but another 4.1 million from simple things like using wood in ovens and burning and cooking and all of those things. Did that surprise you as well?
Yes, absolutely. I think there's a lot of things that have surprised me in this story, the air pollution story. One of them is the range, as you say, of sort of pollutants and things that contribute to dirty air in big cities in the developed world, in wealthy countries. We have people, you know, a real trend in recent years for these sort of wood-burning stoves and a cozy fire at home. I'm as much of a sucker as the next person for snuggling up in front of a roaring fire. But it turns out it's actually a really big source of pollution and in some ways worse than diesel vehicles, because burning of wood is a big creator of these tiny little particles called PM2.5, which penetrate really deeply into your body. But I think the other thing that surprised me is the range of sort of health problems that it can cause, the range of the effects. You know, I think we're sort of ready for the idea that air pollution makes your asthma worse, or it can cause bronchitis or even lung cancer. But actually, the respiratory effects are really only a small piece of what air pollution does to you. You know, heart attacks, strokes, all kinds of cardiovascular problems, cognitive problems, Alzheimer's, mental illness. This is really just across the board health problems that can result from air pollution. And I think when you stop and think about the way that the air that you breathe permeates your entire body, it actually shouldn't really be surprising that it can cause this huge range of effects.
And again, the other interesting thing is the scale of the problem you chart, and we're not talking just about developing nations, but as you say, we're talking about cities like London. is we know parents, for example, with children who have asthma would be alert to the risks and they would check for the air quality, for example. But actually, the majority of us, we just do go on. As you say, we smell the nice fire. We don't say, you know, if someone was smoking a cigarette next to us, we'd say, hey, put out that cigarette, potentially. Yeah. And if someone's next door got a nice wood-burning fire, a stove, we think, oh, well, that's their business. It's nothing to do with that. Do you think we're a little bit complacent? And again, maybe making this a bit of a big question, but the other thing is whenever you hear, you know, X hundred of people potentially have died because of air pollution, you don't quite understand the link in a way.
I think that's very true. And I think that's something that is really particular to this problem and sort of is pernicious about this problem, which is that you don't really see it. And yes, we have these numbers. You know, there's a statistic that in London, upwards of 9,000 people may die every year from the effects of air pollution. That's 20% of all deaths in London. But, you know, you can never say who it is. There may be a rare, very severe case where, you know, you can directly link a particular person's problems, health problems, to air pollution. But generally speaking, it's more invisible than that. And I think that's part of why we've kind of let it continue and let it fester and never really confronted this problem. It takes scientists and statisticians and, you know, numerical models to actually see it. If you have a heart attack or I have a stroke and we live in a polluted place, you know, that may have caused it, but it also may be because I never go to the gym. You know, you can't sort of nail it down. But actually, when you look in the bigger picture at a population level, at the level of a city or a region or a country, scientists can see, and it's very clear, not just the link between rises in air pollution and increases in all these different health problems, but very literally the number of deaths goes up when the air pollution rises. And I think the brighter side of that is that the converse is also true. In places where regulation and other measures have started to bring air pollution down, very quickly you see the death rate reduce. So for sure, lives are taken when air pollution goes up and they're saved when it goes down. But it's hard to draw the connection to the naked eye.
Now, we're in a city where actually at city level, they have taken some decisions to introduce a new zone that will be for restricting the most pollutant vehicles from coming into the centre. But or they'll still be allowed, but they'll be taxed at a kind of higher rate via the congestion charge process as well. Again, that's kind of rumbled on. And I think many Londoners think it's probably a good idea. But as far as you're concerned, that's a vital and important step. And especially because we have had this problem of diesel as well.
It is important. You're talking about some of the measures that Sadiq Khan is bringing in over the next months and years. And I don't want to minimize that at all because I think it is significant. It will, you know, hopefully bring some benefit. And really, his actions represent the first effort at all taken on this issue in this country for probably upwards of 10 years now. But I think that there's a limit to what a city can do, what a mayor can do. And I think that Sadiq Khan would be the first one to tell you that. He said that he's sort of fighting this problem with one hand tied behind his back. And the reason for that is that this is just something that needs to be tackled at the national level and really, in many cases, at the EU level. Sure, Sadiq Khan can restrict what vehicles come into certain parts of London. At the moment, it's a fairly small section of very, very central London. But as long as this country and as long as really all of Europe is filled with these diesel cars that not only are they very polluting, but they're breaking the rules. They're not following the law. You know, obviously, we've heard over the last few years about this huge cheating scandal involving VW. It's a lot of other car makers, too. And as long as we have all these diesels on the road all over the country, all over Europe, that are not observing the regulations that they're supposed to be following, there's only so much that one city can do. London, you know, Sadiq Khan can't keep all cars out of the city. And because of these failures of enforcement, which I feel are really the key to the problem, UK-wide and Europe-wide, the diesel cars driving around this country are very polluting.
And tell me, at the beginning of our interview, you said US cities are actually better than European cities. Mm-hmm. Is that down to density or you just had fewer VWs on your roads in the United States?
You know, when you talk about what's happened across Europe in terms of pollution, I think of it as there being the sort of immediate cause, there's a proximate cause, and then there's a bigger picture. The immediate cause, like we've been talking about, is diesel. Diesel is much more polluting than petrol. Europeans, for various reasons, including government incentives have embraced diesel much more than Americans have. But I think that the bigger picture and sort of the root cause is a real failure of enforcement in the UK and across Europe. And it's funny because we're used to thinking of America, and usually rightly so, as environmentally a real laggard. You know, Americans drive these huge gas-guzzling SUVs. Our carbon footprint is huge and our recycling is terrible compared to the UK and Europe. But air quality regulation has been an area where the US has been much more successful than Europe. Of course, the Trump administration is really taking a battering ram to all of that now. But over the past 40 or 45 years, since 1970, when the American Clean Air Act was passed, the U.S. government has built up this agency, the Environmental Protection Agency, which has been, compared to Europe, very well resourced and gotten the expertise to enforce the law. Europe has failed to do that, and that's why VW and these other companies have been able to get away with this kind of cheating.
Tell me, if you were a dad or a mom just about to have a young child, if you were getting older and you were concerned about your mental health, the risks of getting Alzheimer's, for example, do you think you'd take the decision to not live in a city?
You know, I think that's a pretty tough call. People have personal lives and jobs and social ties that keep them in a place where they live. I don't really think we should have to make those decisions. I think we should be able to live in cities that don't make us sick. There are measures that you can take short of pulling up sticks and moving. One thing that I try to do, and I think about it really every time I go out, is to avoid busy roads as much as I can, whether you're driving or walking. You know, can you cut through a park, or can you even walk on a quieter street?
That short distance away from the big polluting highways does make a difference.
It does make a difference because, particularly in the case of diesel, the big pollutant is something called nitrogen dioxide, and that's a very localized sort of pollutant. So even if you're a few hundred meters away from a big road, so like I said, you walk on a quieter road that runs parallel, or you take a slightly longer route to get where you're going, it does make a big difference, and you can cut your exposure by, you know, half or more.
Well, that was Beth Gardner, and her book is called Choked: The Age of Air Pollution and the Fight for a Cleaner Future. And it's going to be out in April. And this is The Urbanist. How can cities deal with storms and hurricanes? Is it possible to be fully prepared? Our bureau chief in Hong Kong, James Chambers, sent us this report on how every year the city braces for a typhoon and why it's remarkably good at dealing with them. Let's listen in.
Sometimes it would be nice, during the height of Hong Kong's hot and humid summer months, to feel a gentle breeze blow in from the South China Sea. But unfortunately, when the wind does get up in the city, it tends to blow a gale. May to October in Hong Kong is typhoon season, so every so often, a tropical storm will start way out east in the Pacific Ocean, cross over the Philippine island of Luzon, and gradually make its way west towards southern China, Taiwan, and Hong Kong. Peak storm season lasts from July to September, and during this time, the talk around the water cooler turns to tracking the movements of the latest typhoon. The fun all starts when one of these weather systems moves within 800 kilometers of the city, and the Hong Kong Observatory issues the first in its series of warnings, known as the standby signal, or T1. As the storm edges closer and gains in strength, these T signals will change over time. The highest number on the scale is a T10, which basically means that the eye of the storm is going to hit the city head-on and bring with it possible wind speeds of 185 kilometers or above. In the early days of Hong Kong, back in the 19th century, these storm warnings would be issued by way of firing a cannon and lighting lanterns in the harbor. But nowadays, it's a bit more high-tech, with little digital T symbols appearing on everyone's smartphones. Physical signs are also placed in the lobbies of office towers, shopping malls, and residential buildings right across the city. Of course, not every T1 becomes a T10. Some never make it past the standby signal, while other strong winds stop at a T3. The all-important number, as far as Hong Kongers are concerned, is a T8. When the Hong Kong Observatory hoists a T8 signal, this is when schools and offices are closed, and students and employees get to stay at home. As a result, rather than live in fear of these storms, many Hong Kongers eagerly watch the numbers go up and pray for a T8 signal to fall on a weekday rather than a weekend. Hong Kong is, after all, a remarkably resilient city, despite its heavy concentration of pencil-thin residential blocks that perch on the side of hills or stand right next to the harbour, seemingly lining up to be toppled over by winds in excess of 100 kilometres per hour. Typhoons batter the city for hours on end, but this extreme weather poses little risk of life to the millions of people sheltering indoors, watching the weather unfold on the TV or out of the window. Last September, Hong Kong suffered its most intense storm since records began. Typhoon Mangkhut made landfall in Hong Kong after reaching wind speeds of 250 kilometers per hour as it crossed the Philippines. This so-called super typhoon, which easily met the requirements of a T10, hit Hong Kong at the same time as the somewhat weaker Hurricane Florence was heading towards the east coast of the U.S.
It is the world's strongest storm so far this year, and tonight, Mangkhut continues its deadly sweep, slamming into Hong Kong before making landfall in southern China.
So while crazed U.S. media channels went into a storm frenzy, Hong Kong calmly prepared for their own once-in-a-lifetime storm of the century by applying a bit of masking tape to rickety single-glazed window panes. When the typhoon hit, tall buildings swayed, some windows were smashed, thousands of trees were uprooted, and videos of cranes swinging around on building sites did the rounds of social media. Billions of dollars in damage, but miraculously no one died. In fact, the saddest thing for most hard-working Hong Kongers was that Typhoon Mangkhut decided to make landfall during Sunday lunchtime. By 5 a.m. on Monday morning, the Hong Kong Observatory had lowered the signal to a T3, so the city woke up the next day and went straight back to work.
That was our Hong Kong bureau chief, James Chambers. Now, it's almost time to head off, but we couldn't wrap today's programme without mentioning one particular creation that truly transformed modern city living: air conditioning. Our own Andrew Mueller investigates.
If you've spent most of your life in one of the world's more temperate or even colder climates, Northern Europe, Scandinavia, Canada, for example, you may not fully appreciate how important air conditioning has been to the development of the modern world. If you're cold, you can always put on another jumper. If you've lived anywhere hot, proper hot, that is, with regular stretches of days of 35 Celsius or above, you will require no persuasion at all that air conditioning is one of the supreme pinnacles of human accomplishment. With all due respect to the struggles of Monocle 24's many Eskimo listeners, extreme heat is enervating and debilitating in a way that extreme cold is not. There is simply no hiding from it. The name of Willis Haviland Carrier should be at least as well known as those of Henry Ford, Alexander Graham Bell and John Logie Baird. Carrier was the American engineer who in 1902, in response to a request from a Brooklyn publishing house called Sackett Wilhelms, designed the first modern air conditioning system.
Carrier, using some principles that he's been developing as a young new employee of this fan company, finds a way to get out the July 1902 run of the Judge magazine, and from there he begins to eventually build his air conditioning empire.
Carrier's invention has proved at least as transformative in its way as the mass-produced automobile, or the telephone, or the television. Without air conditioning, much of what we take for granted as modern urban living would be impossible. Air conditioning permits such vast indoor communal spaces as shopping malls and airport terminals. It cools computer servers. It prevents museum and gallery exhibits from wilting. It makes cinemas and theatres a viable summertime leisure option. Indeed, if it's really hot outside, it can sometimes make cinemas and theatres worth visiting, even despite the movies and plays.
Not all of us can visit the beach these hot, humid days, for there's shopping to be done, despite the heat. Well, here's the way to do that shopping and beat the heat at the same time. Visit the store with a blue and white sign, Air Conditioned by Westinghouse.
Even more than that, air conditioning has expanded the range of places where enough people are going to want to live to make malls and airports and galleries and theatres worth building. Many of the great 20th century boom towns of the southern United States, Atlanta, Houston, Miami, were created by air conditioning as surely as railways opened up the West. It may have been oil that made the Gulf states rich, but it is air conditioning that makes rich people want to live in them, and people who wish they were rich want to take holidays in them. China and India would both have boomed less dramatically in recent years if their factories and laboratories were altogether at the mercy of their climates. It is because of air conditioning that it is possible, if not necessarily desirable, to hold the next World Cup in Qatar, a broiling sandpit in which the only outdoor pursuit possible otherwise would be competitive fainting. Air conditioning has not merely changed our world, but to a substantial extent created our world, for good and for ill. The energy we have spent changing our climate has contributed to changing our climate, and that, in turn, will require the expenditure of still further energy to keep our cool, especially since many of the world's hottest countries have barely entered the market. While 90% of American homes have air conditioning, only 16% of Brazilian homes, 9% of Indonesian homes, and 5% of Indian homes do. By the best guesses of the International Energy Agency, by 2050, global demand for air conditioning will exceed 5.6 billion units. Right now, the IEA estimates there are no fewer than 1.6 billion air conditioners in operation, and right there might be some sort of solution. That's roughly one air conditioner for every five people in the world. Maybe if we all just bunched up a bit.
That was Monocle's contributing editor and a voice, of course, on Monocle 24, Andrew Muller. Well, that's all for this week's episode of The Urbanist. This show was produced by Carlotta Ribello and also by David Stevens, who also edited it too. And to play you out of this episode of The Urbanist, well, here's the French duo Air with People in the City. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.